my morning today, because as always, you know, like when you plan an episode, like you have like all your ideas of like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to consume all the things.
Yes.
And I was like, I've already read the book, so all I have to do is watch the film. And then it comes to this morning, and I come downstairs at like 8 a.m. and I'm like, I'll watch the film this morning, it'll be fine and easy. I didn't realise how long that fucking film was. It's 3.5 hours.
Oh my god, I saw how long the film was, and I was just like, maybe I won't do that.
I had breakfast while watching the film. I also had lunch while watching the film. Hi, I'm Mark.
Hi, I'm Sophie.
And this is You Know What I Like, where we sit down each month and flail about something that we are unhealthily obsessed with. You Know What I Like, Dr. Zhivago. Dr. Zhivago is a book written by Boris Pasternak. It was published in 1957, following it being smuggled out of the USSR due to its anti-revolutionary ideas. It was originally published in Italy before spreading to the rest of the world. Pasternak won the Nobel Prize for Literature for Dr. Zhivago, which he had to publicly reject due to still living within Russian borders. Dr. Zhivago follows the story of Yuri Andreyevich Zhivago between the failed revolution of 1905 through the actual Russian Revolution of 1917 and through to the beginning of World War II. Through the years, Yuri finds his life constantly entwined with that of Lara Antipova, despite their marriages to other people. Both the book and the Academy Award-winning film of 1965 tell the story of the lead-up to the revolution and the day-to-day life in the horrendous decades of the fall. It deals with themes of idealism, loss, and is touted by some as containing one of the great romances between its two leads.
If you could see the face I'm making to that final point. Sadly, this is an audio podcast.
I did want to give a bit of a trigger warning for this book and this episode. I don't know how much we're going to go like into depth about it, but it does touch on childhood abuse, sexual assault, and a bunch of other things like that.
Yeah, it's pretty
so
heavy.
If that's not for you, then maybe skip this episode and we will be back for you next month.
Yes.
So, Sophie, what is your experience with Dr. Zhivago?
Well, I had obviously heard of Dr. Zhivago because it is immensely famous. But to be honest with you, I was familiar with the name and I knew the story that it had to be smuggled out to be published. But I honestly did not know at all what it was about. And then I read it specifically for this episode. So it's been an interesting process of sort of going in a little bit blind and just being like, huh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel like I would agree with that, like, experience of reading it. I think I've talked about it on this podcast before. I'm having a Russian history moment very strongly focused around the revolution because I just find it all very interesting.
Yes, your Goodreads account really makes that clear.
It does. I read about a book in Vogue, which is a phrase that childhood me would be like, oh my god, who are we now? And, like, it was a book review of a book called The Secrets We Kept by Lara Prescott that sold itself as a story about two female spies trying to smuggle the book out of Russia. It is not that. It's not a very good romance, is what it ends up being. But I did end up picking up the actual book. I thought it would be a great, like, example of historical fiction to tell me more about what life is actually like after the revolution that I'd read so much about. How did you feel when you were reading it? Were you enjoying it? Were there bits that like you liked or disliked? Anything that jumps out at you?
On the whole, I really enjoyed it. I was sort of surprised by how readable I found it, insofar mm-hmm. as I think sometimes there can be like expectations, especially because I know like it's a chunky one, it's Russian literature, you know, like, so I was pleasantly surprised. Off the top of my head, I currently don't have a note of who translated the version that I read, because I'm aware that translated fiction, a lot of the time the translator can make such a difference.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it on the whole, and I read it much faster than I expected myself to. I think my favourite parts were, I found the descriptions of the physicality of Russia really interesting, which was unexpected, I think. It took me like a little bit of time at the start to settle into who all the characters were and which characters were going to be like more relevant than others and that sort of thing. So the things that got me at the beginning were really, and then like throughout the rest of it, were really like these descriptions of like place, because that was sort of, I didn't need to remember characters' names to enjoy those bits. I could just like settle into that and be like, okay, and who are you again?
I've only read two classic Russian books so far, and I feel like they both have had the same issue where when you're first starting out, like, you don't know who the main characters are really yet. So you're trying to retain all of these small bits of information about like everyone that you meet, because you don't know who's going to keep being relevant and what is just like a bit of fun world flavor. Yet.
Yeah, I spent a while being like, who is gonna be the doctor?
Yeah. I feel like one of the things that made me stick with this book so quickly from the start is, like, as you say, the like atmospheric writing of it. Because like there's a scene right at the very beginning, just after Yuri, his mum's funeral, and he is taken to sleep in the basement of the church that is nearby. And there's that scene where he wakes up in the night and he's underground, but there's like a blizzard happening outside. And he walks up to the window with the branch that's like tapping on the window and the snow that's happening outside. And that just felt so atmospheric to me that like I could fully picture what it looked like, how it felt. And that just really sucked me right in.
Mm.
That carries across as you go through for things like there's like a long portion of the book where Yuri and his wife Tonya are traveling east to yes. get away from the city after the revolution. And you have all those scenes where they're on this train and they're just flying through the countryside. And you just get this like sense of like how much snow is around them, how much nature is around them.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things as well where, obviously, we live on a relatively small island. Mm-hmm. And so the sheer vastness of Russia as a place is just, like, occasionally, like, if you think about it too hard, it's kind of mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that bit when they're travelling on the train and they're just going across country, like, I really found myself really enjoying like getting sort of understandings of what the different places are like and sort of this that divide between like city and country and that sort of thing. That was one of the portions that it could have been really dull in some ways.
Oh, yeah.
Like we're literally just traveling on a train and we are still traveling on the train.
If you describe it to someone, it sounds really boring.
Yeah, but I think actually, especially because of the descriptions of the where they're traveling through, but then also when they make the stops and then you sort of get a sense of how the different places are all experiencing sort of the same political moment and that sort of thing. I just felt like it worked really well to keep it as a segment where I didn't find myself bored. I was actually like, oh yeah, sure, let's keep traveling on the train.
yeah. But it does such a good job of capturing what life is like when you have this constant turmoil that's happening that feels like at the start, like it is just happening in the main cities, in Moscow, in Petrograd. And then you get to go on this journey that like is a really, really long journey. And you still see that every single person in the country is affected by this event of the revolution. And like experience it more firsthand than just like hearing someone talk about what's happening in the country. That it just makes it feel so much more alive.
It's that thing where sometimes I think people try and create a figure who's like a universal figure to tell these stories, whereas sometimes people do it differently and they just show you lots of different people's experiences. And it's like two different ways of trying to do the same thing, which is like encapsulate a political moment. found myself really rooted in understanding like the different ways that different characters had approached and responded to, and philosophically, practically, like across all spectrums of life, not just like physically what is happening to this character, but like how do they emotionally deal with it, how do they philosophically engage with what is being, you know, said and changed and that sort of thing. And I felt like that was a really interesting aspect of it.
You can really pull a lot out of this, because like I feel like you can get the plot, like the plot of the film as like I watched it, is what happens to Zhivago and to Lara, and you do lose all of that world building stuff. There's one character who you hear about, I don't remember his name right now, but he's like a leader of the local revolution who then Zhivago meets on a train, and they have this like back and forth conversation about how Zhivago is trying to come home from the war to return to what he thinks is going to be some degree of normality. And this guy is like, mate, the world has fucking moved on.
We've had this discussion before privately, not on the podcast, I don't think, in regards to Anna Karenina, where we talked about how like film adaptations really take Anna's storyline as like the main plot. And so most film adaptations are telling you that. And then there's like a little bit of the other characters around, you know, like it's really exploring like a moment in Russian history. And because you have so many characters, you get to see so many different like class experiences and different like philosophical approaches to life and like that sort of thing. And I think, again, I don't mean to just compare like the two main Russian books that I've read.
Yeah, so.
But it's just like, you know, both of these texts have this big cast of characters, and they are both like exploring like different like political outlooks and that sort of thing. Whereas then if you boil that down to a film, like I understand why the film kind of gets boiled down to like the love story and the blah, because it's just like, how do you encapsulate all of these things when the film is already like 3.5 hours long?
It's way too long.
Yeah, you know, like it's already too long. And then you're like, and you want me to try and get all of this in as well?
Yeah. Speaking of affairs, though, with Anna Karenina, we have Zhivago, who he marries Tonya, who is like his childhood friend who he grows up with. And then Lara, she marries Pasha Antipov, who is like also a childhood friend. And they both get married. They both have a kid. And then I feel like it all kicks off when they both serve in World War One, and they meet and they're both working in this medical facility.
We should say they have like sort of moments where their lives touch slightly, but they don't really register who each other are.
Yes.
So you get almost like this little like circling arrangement where it's like their spheres are overlapping a bit, but they don't properly actually like meet until later.
Yeah. And then they have an affair. They both go back and forth on who they want to be with. And then, like, as the book goes forwards, Tonya is exiled to Paris with her father. So then she's out of the picture. And then Yuri can then... Him and Lara then end up... They live in the same house that he lived in with Tonya. And I feel like when people talk about this book and this film, they talk about it, everyone's like, oh yes, it's this tale of the revolution and what our real life is, but really it's a romance.
It's not though, because I knew that this is talked about, like my copy of the book says, one of the greatest love stories of all time on the front.
Mm-hmm.
They actually don't spend that much of the book together.
No.
I kept expecting to reach a point where they would spend more time together and have these like sweepingly romantic moments, which is not what happens.
No.
But even when, because plot contrivances, like Zhivago like has stretches where he's like doesn't know where Lara is and so is with Tonya, and then there's later a time he's with both Tonya and Lara, and then there's a bit later where he doesn't know where Tonya is so he's with Lara. To be honest with you, for most of that, like, he seems quite happy to just have both.
Yeah, that does make it hard to root for when, I mean, like, I don't know if that is the point, and like popular culture has like misinterpreted what he intended.
Forgive me, because there's a chance that I might have misunderstood the ending. He ends up with someone completely different at the end, doesn't he?
Oh, he does, you're right. Yeah,
he shacks up with someone else.
He's living on his own in a flat, and he marries the person who lives in the flat below as well.
Which in some ways, like, I kind of liked. I think the thing is I don't think I hated it in the text. The reasonings he has for the reasons why he's interested in Tonya and why he's interested in Lara, I didn't view it in text as, like, this beautiful sweeping romance. I viewed it as, like, these two people who have a connection, but he also equally, like, he really values his relationship with Tonya, and he values, like, the family they have together. And then right at the end, because Tonya is exiled to Paris and presumably has also heard about him and Lara and is like, no thanks, you can stay.
Yeah, I'm good.
But so then he ends up with someone completely different. I think the thing that I have, like, this reaction to is like that branding that's on the front of my book that's like one of the greatest love stories ever told. And I'm just like, I just don't feel like that's real.
I mean, like, it's kind of like when we were talking about the blurb of last month and we're like, I feel like we read different books here.
Yeah. I would be really interested to hear from people who do view this as like a sweeping love story and what it is about it that gives them those feelings. I would genuinely be interested to hear that because, you know, as we continue to say every time we analyze texts, we're like, you know, the joy of literature is we all come away with our own readings. So I'm not like standing here being like, I don't want people who are listening to this who do view it as romantic to be like, oh, you're shitting on me, because we're not. Obviously enough people do read it as yearning and longing and separation and finding each other and that sort of thing. It's just that that's just not the experience that I had.
Yeah. So for me, like, I can see some of where it's coming from because I can see the romantic ideals around the fact that they do keep, like, almost meeting. And I can see how, like, people can like to think that there is someone who they are, like, destined to be with, who you just have to be paying attention in the right moment, like they do where they just, like, when they end up in the war together and they are finally able to form a connection. And then how once they leave the war and they go their separate ways, how they keep finding each other. And I can see the romantic ideals around that. But I feel like for me, what clouds that and obscures that almost completely for me is the context of this happening in the revolution and the fact that to me, it doesn't read like an idealistic romance. To me, it reads like people who have a connection and are like attracted to each other, but they're in this horrible time of their lives, in a horrible cultural moment where everything around them is falling apart and they're constantly being threatened to be killed. They know people who are being killed and they are just able to form, I don't want to say the word like animalistic because that feels gross, but that's the word that popped into my head. But like, it's kind of like they're looking for comfort. And they're finding comfort in each other because they do have a connection. But I don't find it in a way where I'm like, I wish I was them because of the world that they are existing in. And I feel like for me, I have to have some level of wanting to be a part of the romance to fully root for a romance, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think what stops me, that's really interesting. I think what stops me from fully like rooting for them is the way in which Lara, even though Pasha left and has created this other life for himself as this revolutionary and that sort of thing, there are like times when she talks to Zhivago and she like verbalizes like she still would choose him in some ways, you know, and she's, and maybe this is me being really like simplistic. I think one thing that makes their relationship interesting is the fact that even though they want to be with each other, they also do still have such strong ties to the other relationships in their life. I don't know if I'm being really naive by thinking that just because people also love X person doesn't mean they can't also love Y person. I don't know. I like that they're able to simultaneously love all of these people at the same time, but it also then makes me struggle to view this as like a romantic sweeping text. I don't know. I don't have a conclusion there. It's just something that I've just been like, huh.
Yeah. One detail that I do like about the romance, and it's not a fact that I like about them together, is that I like how Zhivago is kind of a dick. In the sense that he is our main character and he has moments where he is sympathetic, but I also don't particularly like him.
Yeah.
And the choices that he makes. Like, the worst one that jumps out to me is towards the end when him and Lara have spent this time together And then Komarovsky comes in, who is the person who groomed her as a child. Komarovsky tells them that they are like about to be killed by people who think that they are traitors. And so Zhivago convinces Lara to take her daughter to go with Komarovsky, and he promises that he is about to follow them. And then he doesn't.
Yeah.
And I just feel like that is such an awful thing to do, where you know that the only reason that she is going with her abuser is because she thinks that Zhivago is coming with her. And then she then has to deal with the situation where she relies on him for safety. And I don't like that he does it, because obviously, like, it's a horrible thing to do. I just think it's a really interesting thing to think about for your main character to do something that terrible to someone that he apparently cares about.
It kind of adds to how I don't know how to feel about their relationship, because also sometimes I question how deep that love is.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in regards to that moment, but I don't know. I feel like he strikes me as someone who can be like, oh, I love you so much. I love you so much. And then, like, he just doesn't actually care. I think, you know, like, the way that it's like, oh, he loves Lara so much, and, like, now his wife is exiled, maybe he could go and be with Lara, but it's like, oh, no, I'm just going to marry this housekeeper.
So, like, that's a detail that when I was listening to the Broadway musical adaptation of, I've not seen it, but when I've heard the soundtrack, it sounds like an adaptation of the film.
Hmm.
And there's a line in a song called Ashes and Tears.
I am Yuri Andreevich Zhivago. I will not leave a legacy of shame.
And I feel like that, like, unlocked something in my brain of how his character works, in that, like, he is always chasing an ideal of what he wants in that moment. So I feel like that could tie into your feeling that you don't really know what he wants, in that when he is with Tonya, he's, like, idealizing himself as, like, a family man. And then when him and Tonya are in the country house and they have, like, a degree of safety, and he realizes that he is living right next to Lara, he can, like, idealize himself as, like, a romantic who has this lady who he has this, he thinks, strong connection to. And then I feel like as he's going through, he's constantly trying to, like, work out which ideal he wants to be, and he doesn't ever really land on one. Because, like, he has that period, like, he keeps saying that he wants to be a poet and a writer, and he has that period where he's in the cottage, and we read, like, a portion of his diary where, like, he's like, I'm going to write in this diary every day. And, like, that will mean that, like, I'm writing every day forever. And then he writes for, like, 3 days. And then that's it. And then he has the period of his poems as well, where he's like, I'm a poet now. And I do like seeing him try on all of these different skins to try to work out who he is. Just a lot of them end up hurting other people.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it. I think you really have. I feel like there's, like, an aspect of his relationships where it's, like, not just the ideal of who he is, but also the ideal of who the other person is.
Mm-hmm.
He idealizes, like, his family relationship when he is with the rebels, but literally they took him as he was coming back from seeing his mistress.
Yes.
So, you know, so I think that is what it is. And I think that's why I find it hard to root for it as a relationship. But it's why I still find it engaging as a text, because I don't like him fully as a human, but I find him extremely interesting to see the way that he views the world and approaches the world. And, like, there's loads of moments, aren't there, where he has, like, philosophical discussions. Like, he does it with Pasha and it with, like, other people, where it's like, oh, like, I can't remember the name of the guy. When he's with the rebels, there's the guy who he is forced to share a room with.
The cocaine guy.
The cocaine guy, who he is like, I found it genuinely hilarious, because the guy would just, like, talk to him non-stop, and he's like, oh my god, I hate you. Like, he's a prisoner there, and he's just verbalizing to his captor, like, I hate you so much, I wish you would die. Every time you talk to me, I want to murder you. Uh-huh. And then the guy's just like,
Lol.
You're so funny, Zhivago.
Yeah.
So it's that thing where it's, like, very weird having these, like, moments that of, like, almost, like, absurdist humor within, like, oh, so you're a captive with this group of rebels, and, like, there's all, you're continually dealing with, like, dead and wounded people that you're forced to heal and blah blah blah, but also, like, there's this one guy who's on coke who is driving you mad.
But like in those scenes though, he's always like saying that it's 2 a.m. He's trying to go to sleep. And this general guy just won't stop talking. And I don't remember if it's like internally or externally, but he's always like, oh my God, all I want is to go to sleep, if he would just shut up. And then he turns to the guy and then like spews out this like philosophical conversation. It's like, you don't want to go to sleep. Like, you clearly want to have this conversation.
Well, and then it's another bit where he's like, oh my God, I'm so tired, I want to go to sleep. And then he actually goes out into the snow and he like is searching for those things in the trees. And it is that almost that thing where it's like he tells himself one thing and then he does another. Like, again, when he keeps being like, I wish you'd fucking die. And then later there's like this opportunity moment and he's like, I'm not going to kill him. It's fine.
Yeah.
Someone else wants to kill him? Oh, that's really outrageous.
Uh-huh.
And it kind of feels like it fits with that time period because everything is quite chaotic and it's like constantly trying to define what progress is and what the correct form of progress is and all of these things. So in many ways, like, I kind of get it that he doesn't, there's almost like this contradiction at his heart because it kind of feels like it's this moment in history where it's like, there's this contradiction at this heart because we're trying to achieve X, but then also like Y. And I don't know, I think it kind of fits.
Yeah, like you have when the revolution happens and you have like all of these like ideals that are thought of as like how the world is going to get so much better. And then the revolution in practice is this hideous, hideous thing because it's being run by these horrible people who don't have the best intentions.
And in some ways, again, not to keep bringing it back to the romantic relationship, but makes me think in regards to like the relationship that like Lara and Pasha have, where in many ways it's like she's has acknowledged that like he has duties to things that are bigger than to the private relationship between the two of them. So in some ways, like, that's how she can still like not blame him for what he's doing, because, you know, like his responsibilities to the cause outweigh his responsibilities to like his wife and child and that sort of thing, which is just like an interesting way of like thinking about that relationship, I guess.
To me as well, like, when, like, I began to think about things like people thinking of themselves to, like, an ideal as well, like we just talked about with Zhivago, I feel like that also, like, applies to Pasha, who then he even goes so far as to make a new name for himself as Strelnikov, that he is also, like, acting out, like, his ideal version of what, like, a man does.
Yeah.
Because he has this very unhealthy and weird relationship to her trauma and to the way that she is, that he feels like he has to like counterbalance that by like being, in quotes, the ideal man.
Well, and also, I also wondered if it was kind of tied to when they're young and he so idolizes her and he will do anything she says. And almost, I wondered if it was like a reaction against that by then like finding another cause, if you will. Like, he is someone mm-hmm. who dedicates himself to things. So he dedicated himself to Lara, and then equally he dedicated himself to this cause. I find Pasha a very interesting like comparative point to Zhivago, because there are both like these ideas of like who should they be and that sort of thing, and they both like approach it differently and have such different like world views at their heart, but that makes them as like the two main men in, well, I guess there are three main men in Lara's life if you also count her abuser.
Boo.
Oh, I hated that.
He's so slimy in a horrible way. But yeah, continue.
But you know, like, I think the two of them serve as like interesting counterpoints to each other.
And Kamarovsky is horrible.
Oh, Kamarovsky's the worst. I hated it when it was happening, and then I hated it when he appeared again. I was like, could we not have just killed him?
I liked when she tried to kill him. That was great.
I loved when she tried to kill him, and I was really sad that it didn't work.
I know. When you're like, a gunshot goes off and you're like, oh, really?
And then it's like, oh, shit.
Yeah, she missed.
Damn. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like we both just took a real minute to just think, what a shit.
Yeah. I wish he was dead.
Yes.
There's one final thing about Dr. Zhivago that I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
I decided to listen to the musical as some prep as well for this, because I realized that it existed after reading the book.
I can't believe there's a musical. That's amazing.
It's such a weird, like, my partner criticized me for like finding the most obscure musical of all time. And I was like, but it's Dr. Zhivago, like, everyone's heard of that. And he was like, but the musical version of it. Some of it, I feel like this is a musical that I need to see on a stage to fully appreciate it. There was one, which I've already mentioned, called Ashes and Tears, that it's one of those songs in a musical where all of the songs that have happened for, like, individual characters all come together in the climax. Everyone sings at the same time, and everyone, like, overlaps, and it's, like, the moment when, like, all of these people finally come together. I just wanted, like, a moment of appreciation for those songs, because I'm a sucker for them every time. And then you have Quartet at the Ballet in, like, Anastasia as well.
Like in Les Mis when they all do One Day More and you're just like,
exactly,
and I'm like, as all the voices mingle, and then I just start crying because I'm just like,
yes,
it's so beautiful how all human voices work. It can be like a happy song, but I'm just weeping.
Did you have anything more to say about Zhivago?
I think it is just a really interesting, multifaceted look at this particular moment in history. I feel like I have read and watched shows and like non-fiction documentaries and stuff about the moment, but I just found experiencing it from this particular like fictional viewpoint was actually like really eye-opening and illuminating, and I enjoyed it.
That kind of feeds in well to my first broader topic.
Ooh.
About the benefits of historical fiction.
Aha, yes.
So what is it that you think about this book helped you to get a better understanding of it rather than just reading a non-fiction book about it?
I really like reading historical fiction of time periods that I would like to explore. One thing that I've been doing lately is, and I know this is non-fiction, so bear with me, I've been really enjoying memoirs of people who lived through moments of history. Like, I read Life and Death in Shanghai by Niang Cheng, and I read Wild Swans by Yong Chang, and both of them cover the Chinese Cultural Revolution. And I found it really helpful because these are very large, broad topics. And
yes,
really, if you're approaching it from like a historical nonfiction point of view, if I was to read a textbook, there would be so many different threads and aspects that tie into like the nuance of lived situations that would need to be covered. Whereas in these nonfiction memoir examples, because I'm so grounded in this one individual's life, it gives me like a real like rooted point from which I can then take in those wider points.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a similar thing with historical fiction in general. It allows you to grapple with some of these larger, more nuanced topics, but you find yourself rooted in like a point that gives you a base to build from. And like, you know, you also add in the joy of like a narrative and human drama and that sort of thing. And I think it's just a really great way to sort of start to deal with some of those bigger things without having to like immediately dive in the deep end.
Yeah, I mean, this feels bad to say, but I feel like it gives you a reason to care more upfront and immediately. And that's not to say, obviously, that real human lives are hard to connect to, but it's just that a textbook is harder to connect to the people than hearing them have dialogue and personalities that come from them and feel a lot more immediate than hearing someone describe what they said and what they did.
Yeah, I think good nonfiction can really humanize history, but bad nonfiction can make it feel really dry. And so historical fiction, as a point, is such a great way to start you off and familiarize you with some of the key names and some of the key moments. You know, like we did our Tudor episode recently,
mm-hmm.
and I would say that by now I have a fairly solid handle on like Tudor nonfiction, but that's only because I spent my childhood years reading gazillion amounts of books by people like Jean Palaidi and Philippa Gregory, who are taking artistic license with some of the history, but it gets you rooted in some of the narratives and it gets you rooted in some of the names and the moments and that sort of thing, which, like, again, I'm just using Tudors as an example because it's a recent one.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas More is an interesting figure because I've read fiction whereby he is this like noble person who was persecuted and that sort of thing. And then I've also read fiction where he is a man full of learning, but who was also inflicted upon others' pain and stuff like that. And then it means that when I then go to non-fiction, I understand that this is now this figure who might have like some controversial aspects and some facets to him. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll go on and I'll do some reading and understand them.
How do you feel about some degree of disclaimer or like asterisk on the text or anything, where it's like, this scene is a lie? But like, how do you feel about people who not make that argument but like bring that up as a point?
I love a good afterword. I read Blood Queen by Joanna Courtney, which is the true story of Lady Macbeth, mm-hmm. aka looking at the actual historical Macbeth that Shakespeare's play was based on. And in the afterword, I thought she did a really great job of, after you've read the book and you've immersed yourself in this narrative and you've had a really wonderful time, and then she was like, this is what we know about this person. I've based this little plot element, we don't have any examples of it, but like I based it on like these sorts of similar things that happened in history and that sort of thing. I really love an author who puts a little afterword into their text.
Yeah, that sounds great.
And like, I think it's a really great way of doing it, because the thing about historical fiction is you do have to take liberties because it's a fiction book. Mm-hmm. I think it's always good to make it clear. Like, I don't know, I just, this portion of this story is pretty spot on and true, but like, obviously, like these bits where we've gone a bit dramatic, like you can enjoy them, you can love them, you can read them, but also like, maybe they're not based on reality. And I like when authors tell me.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm a one-off.
That's made me think about the context of the person who you are fictionalizing. Because there are fictional versions of people that are written about people who are still alive and like about like events that are very contemporary and still can still like affect what is happening nowadays. So like you have things like the Tudors, like trying to say that like Henry VIII was nice when he was actually not. That's not going to affect anyone now. The one that's coming to mind is that film American Sniper that was about this guy who was in the army. I don't fully know, so some of these details might be wrong, but it was like a fictionalized version of his life, and it glossed over all the times that he was a horrendous human being and just portrayed him as this hero. And I feel like that kind of thing can cause damage. And I feel like that's the line that you have to walk.
Yeah, an example I can think of is a film that I have not seen, but I did see some criticism of The Greatest Showman, because that's a story that could have been told without attaching P.T. Barnum's name to it.
Yes.
Because he is someone who did actively make the lives of the people who worked for him less good. And I think that that's like a valid argument in that point, like things that don't always need to be rooted in real people. Like there's historical fiction that tells the story of real figures, and then there's historical fiction where you have a fictional person who is in a historical moment. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes it's like that thing of like, does this need to be a historical figure? Could this be just a fictional figure in a historical moment?
Have you got any historical fiction that you tout as like a favourite?
I recently read one that I didn't like.
Okay.
That's all I can think of right now.
Do you know why you didn't like it? Like, was it linked to it being historical fiction, or was it just you didn't like the book?
It's very specific. So, I have a thing with historical fiction sometimes. Historical fiction where we are not telling the story of a real historical figure. It is a fictional person in a historical moment. I get annoyed when horrendously famous people are brought into the text in a way that feels disingenuous to me.
Okay.
I had one recently, The Birth of Venus by Sarah Dunant. There were like three different instances. There's like this nameless painter who is painting a thing for their family, and he's always referred to as the painter until a point where his name is given. And he is so ridiculously famous that I read the page and verbally told it to fuck off. I was like, this fits with none of the historical biography that we have of this real life person who existed. Mm-hmm. They've just been shoehorned in And I think it was because it was done in a way that felt like a shock reveal rather than like a proper aspect of her story.
Okay.
I think where I get annoyed sometimes is when it was just like, let's introduce this really famous name so we can tick it off of our list,
mm-hmm.
rather than let's have a plot tying into this historical figure in a way that really like works for the narrative we're telling, I mm-hmm. think.
You've made me think of a version of historical fiction that I also have an issue with. So the context of this is a comic that I read called Project Superpowers that is a bunch of comic book characters who were from the 40s originally, and then they come back in modern day in Captain America style, but it was like a whole group of them. But the conceit of why they get trapped is because someone accidentally unleashes pure evil from this urn, and the only way to stop this evil from spreading is to put the good from these superheroes into the urn.
Pandora's jar kind of situation.
Yeah, but like you're cramming in people instead. <Yeah. laughs> But then the implication was that because this ultimately does not work, because he unleashes evil in the early 1940s, all of the evil that is perpetuated by the Nazis is because he unleashed this evil. And the thing that bugs me is when you minimize real world events by trying to put them into your narrative. You shouldn't be trying to say they only did those horrible things because this guy in this book unleashed all evil. I just feel like that minimizes what actually happened.
No, I feel you on that. I think it's that flip side where like really good historical fiction, and there's so much of it out there, can make you understand moments of history so much more because you're rooted in the humanity of them and you understand like what experiences must have been like for your average people or for your famous people, you know, that sort of thing. And then the flip side is that bad historical fiction can sometimes just feel a bit gimmicky or sometimes a bit reductionist. And it's that thing of trying to strike the right balance between like rooting you in a human story while also not like diminishing or reducing like what the actual events were, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I did have a second broader topic, but I feel like we've already discussed it. So
great, look at us achieving.
The topic was going to be like around good romances in fiction. But I feel like if you can take anything away from what we've said, it's don't cheat on your partner. Don't begin with an affair.
Or like, you're gonna have an affair. Give me something that like tears at my heart, you know? Give me something where I feel that conflict and I feel like the moral conflict and that sort of thing, because I just never felt like he was very fussed.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. What helps me care about a couple is seeing them interact and enjoying their interactions. But we never get to see them really interacting other than like either wanting after each other, one of them is dying, or they're having sex. And that's kind of all we see them do.
I just didn't feel like they were together that much. So I didn't really feel like I really had a sense of who they were as a couple.
I feel like our checklist is pretty small.
We're not asking for very much.
No.
And yet, the bar is so low.
Yes. At the end of each episode, we each assign a number of flailings to the thing that we've been discussing. Sophie, how many flailings do you give Dr. Zhivago?
Maybe 6.5.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if I should make it a 6 or a 7, so I'm just going in between, I think.
Very solid effort. How come it's not higher? How come it's not lower?
I enjoyed it. I had a fun time. I think I was a tiny bit fatigued by the end of the book.
I feel like I was the same. Did you read his poetry at the end of this book?
I did not read the poetry.
I also did not read his poetry. I was like, sure, he wrote poetry, great, I'm done, bye.
I know. I was like, oh, I'll be fine. I probably don't need it. It'll be all right.
I'm tired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did enjoy it, and I felt very immersed, and I felt very atmospheric. I literally read it in like a handful of days, which does go to
I don't understand how you did that. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think I read it in like 3 days. So I like enjoyed it enough to do that. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I don't know if it's one that I would be like, I want to flail at people about it. I think that's it. Like, if someone wanted to have a conversation with me about it, I would be like, yeah, sure, let's have a chat. And Mr. S, it is his copy of the book that I read, and he is going to be reading it. So I will have some interesting conversations with him for sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's just when it's like flailing, I don't feel like I'm in my upper echelons of flailability.
Mm-hmm. I am the same, even though like I chose this as my episode for the same kind of reasons. In that I feel like I would probably give it like a 7. Because I don't want to flail about it to people. I want to write essays about it. And I feel like that's a different level of enjoyment of a text.
It's a different mood.
Yeah. There have been things that I've given like a 10 to. Where like someone brings it up and my arms are in the air. You know, like I'm flailing everywhere.
Yeah.
But I'm not that enthusiastic about it. Because, like, with both the film and the book, when it was done, I was happy it was done.
Yeah.
Because they're both very long and very dense. There's a lot that happens. It's not particularly fun. I'm really selling this book, aren't I? I'm really selling this book.
But that, it's effective. Because, you know, reading a book about the revolution that's showing you the realities of it is not going to be a fun time. I do think it's a good piece of literature. It's just, I'm very in control of my limbs when I talk about it, whereas normally, if I'm enthusiastic, the hands are flapping away. Here, we're fairly in control.
We didn't talk about the most depressing line of the book. Right at the end, when we're like recapping what happened to Lara and her daughter after she leaves Zhivago. And then like the final line about her is that, wait, I've got it written down. It's really fucking depressing. I'm going to read it to you now.
Can't wait.
They talk about the fact that she was probably killed in a purge in like a labor camp somewhere, and then just like offhandedly says she was a nameless number on a list that was later misplaced.
Yeah.
And it's just like you've spent the entire book with her, and then she's just gone.
Which does hammer it home.
How do you end this book? The main character is just like written off in a sentence.
Yeah. Oh dear.
And that's the end. Oh, we laugh or we'd cry.
Oh dear. Yeah, okay. Well, should we do the conclusion?
You're welcome. And that's the end of this episode of You Know What I Like. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean, and please leave a rating and a review. It helps other people to find the show, and we'd love to be able to play a lot.
We hope that you've enjoyed listening to us ramble, and please follow the podcast on Twitter at ykwilpodcast, or drop us an email at ykwilpodcast@gmail.com. Come back next month when we get overly excited about Howl's Moving Castle.
See you then.